21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for award-winning 21st Century Radio. Here's your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Abracadabra. Make Professor Paul H. Stratner appear at your next event. As a professed artist of legerdemain, he will amaze, amuse, and astound you and your guests with his magical entertainment and subtle humor. For more information, visit his website at www.professortratner.com or call the magic number 410-664-6240. That's 410-664-6240. Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. This is Dr. Bob Hieronymus, and our executive producer, research assistant, is Laura Cordner. Our engineer is Jake Bryant, and you're listening to Telesma, Egyptian Sun. There they go. Well, so now you know, Columbus was not the first to discover America. And that Columbus probably was not an Italian, but perhaps a Spanish Jew. But that doesn't mean that our colleges and universities will add these to their curriculum within the next decade or so. You're still going to have to struggle with old stuff there. Now, there are so many possibilities of who were the ancient Americans and who came to America first that you need to re-educate yourself on some mind-boggling research that every 2 months will be continually sent to you if you subscribe to Ancient American Magazine, the voice of alternative viewpoints. And with us for the first hour and a half is its editor-in-chief, Frank Joseph. And Frank Joseph became the editor-in-chief of Ancient American Magazine when it was founded in 1993. His 20 books, my God, 20 books, which have been published in various languages throughout the world, include Discovering the Mysteries of Ancient America and Opening the Ark of the Covenant. Welcome back to 21st Century Radio, Frank.
Thank you very much, Bob. It's great to be back.
20 books.
Yeah, I know. Too many books.
No, I didn't say it's too many. It's just great. It's just great that you've had the time to, because your books are solid research, and that makes a very big difference in regards to the quality of the stuff that goes out there into people's minds.
Well, thank you. That's very kind of you to say so, and I'll have to live up to that compliment.
Well, you have no choice now. It's against the rules. It's against the law for you not to. Well,
yeah.
This past issue, number 81, December 08, 2008, is another winner for any American who desires to know their roots. But first, tell us a little bit about why such a publication is necessary and how our listeners can subscribe.
Well, Ancient American, I think, is a very unique magazine because it's the only publication that's available for average people like ourselves, except you, Bob. Of course, you're an extraordinary personality. But for the rest of us, mortals, it's a very useful and informative, a door. It opens a door on our past that has been closed, has not been seen or accessed. And what I mean to say is that we are told in our schools that there was nobody in North America from overseas before Columbus except those people who had migrated across a kind of a theoretical land bridge. It's never been proved that such a thing ever existed, linking Alaska to Russia, and that these people were Siberians who crossed over about 13,000 years ago. They're the only inhabitants of North America, and somehow, over the course of time, they diverged into physically radically different tribes. Also, that's not explained how that happened. But in any case, that's the paradigm. That is what I was brought up with, and I'm sure that everybody has been brought up with. And the educational establishment has told us that Columbus was the first and only discoverer of North America. Now, there's no proof, no evidence whatsoever of anybody being here before. And that's a line that's drawn in the sand by academics. And so if you bring up certain things that don't quite fit in with this paradigm, they are immediately dismissed as being either a hoax. For example, if a coin is found, like a Roman coin, is found by a farmer, he digs it up. And they say, well, how would this get here, you know? And they say, well, it was, the explanation usually, of course, is that there were these coin collectors who were very loose with their change, as it were, and were just careless with these treasures, and they're spreading them all over the Midwest.
Yeah, I know that all farmers carry in their pockets some Greek and Roman coins every now and then, just so they can lose them.
Right. Either that or the archaeologists will say, well, this was an attempt on the part of the farmer to make the archaeological establishment look bad.
Oh.
These are the real arguments that the archaeologists come up with. Either that or mostly these discoveries are just plain ignored. So we decided that these discoveries should not be ignored and that we're not archaeologists, admittedly. We don't have the sheepskin that these other fellows have gone through so many years to obtain. We're just ordinary folks who are coming up with these rather peculiar finds, and we're making them available for the masses of our people.
Well, thank heavens you are. And so for 6 months, it will cost you about what? What does it cost? About $36 for 6 months.
That's correct.
Right, and that's two issues, excuse me, one issue every 2 months.
That's correct.
Okay, now, for years, we've been following your articles on Spelunker Russell Burroughs, who on April the 2nd, 1982, discovered what's now called Burroughs Cave. Tell us about this discovery.
Mr. Burroughs is a woodworker, originally from West Virginia. He married a lady in Illinois, and they settled down outside the little town of Olney, Illinois. This is in the southeastern part of the state, very rural area, not much for population. And he claims that he literally fell into an opening, into an area, a remote area, while he was out treasure hunting. Well, if that's the case, he got more than he bargained for, because this hole led into a series of underground tunnels, corridors. He claims that these corridors and tunnels, they would lead out to chambers, some of them fairly substantial, but most of them rather small rooms, man-made rooms. And in these rooms, he removed literally thousands, as much as 7,000 artifacts. And these artifacts are mostly comprised of what is known as mudstones. These are locally obtained stones that have been carved and feature beautiful representations of men and women, mostly men, but women also, from overseas. And according to the attire that these people are featured wearing, they resemble people from the Roman era. Mm-hmm. The helmets have been identified as a type of cavalry helmet that was worn at the time of Rome. The Roman period I'm referring to specifically is right at the very end of the earliest Christian era. In other words, Christ supposedly is crucified around 30 A.D. That's what these people appear to have lived in, the same era, about 30 to 40 A.D. And so the amount, the sheer volume of these objects that Russell Burroughs has removed from 1982 until he closed the cave in 1989 is astounding. I've seen, not thousands, but I have seen hundreds, many hundreds of artifacts that he removed. Some of them are crudely made. Others are masterpieces. And you, Bob, as an artist, would really be able to appreciate some of the high level of workmanship that's gone into the portrayal of mostly profiles of human beings. Some of the stones are not this mudstone, rather common stone, but some are in marble. mm-hmm. local marble.
Well, there in issue 81, we find some marble artifacts taken from this cave, and also we'll touch on a mystic symbol ship artifact. So tell us a little bit about these are fascinating marble pieces, especially you have a head of what it looks almost like to be some kind of a bird.
Right. That bird would seem to be, this is an interpretation, but it's a credible interpretation. It seems to be an emblem of some kind, mm-hmm. a royal emblem. From all the research that's gone in over the past now more than 20 years on the Burroughs Cave artifacts, it would appear that there was a rift in the Roman world between Caesar. At that time, this we're talking about Caligula, who was quite a horrible human being, and one of his colonies. This colony was known as Mauritania, and the emblem for Mauritania appears to have been very similar to this avian design that we have, kind of like an eagle or a hawk. I'm not quite sure. It's not really that identifiable, mm-hmm. but it's a hawk-like figure that is found at Burroughs Cave. That's another piece of the puzzle that seems to identify this site at southern Illinois as being a sepulcher, as being a burial site for people who fled the wrath of Rome about 40 A.D., and they chose this area to bury their dead. The work that we're referring to in the present issue of Ancient American was undertaken by a tremendous geologist. His name is Scott Walter. And he has used electron microscopes in addition to his 18 years of expertise as a professional geologist. And he examined some of the marble, not some of the mudstones. I should explain, I guess, what the mudstones are. Mudstones in southern Illinois are clay that is removed from a riverbank. And this clay has a very high iron content. So you can remove it, say, with a chisel or a scalpel of some kind. Just pull it out of the riverbank, and then you can write on it very easily with a stylus. You set this mud out into the sun to dry, and it turns into very hard rock. That's how most of the stones from Burroughs Cave appear. However, there are a large number of these beautiful marbles. It's completely different. And it was these marbles that Scott Walter turned his expertise in, his electron microscope, to examine. And in a nutshell, the article is brief, but it's scientifically written, and it's accessible, but it requires a little concentration to get through it. But in a nutshell, Scott Walter's article that appears as a feature lead article in this latest issue of Ancient American indicates that the deposition or the settling material that's on top of these stones would indicate that they had to be inside of a cave-like environment for a very long time. Mm-hmm. In order for this kind of deposition to have accumulated to the degree that it is now. In other words, what he's saying is that if these things were fake, and mainstream archaeologists insist that they are fake, that Russell Burroughs and or his friends were busily manufacturing 7,000 or more of these artifacts for the past several years to sell, that you would not have this kind of deposition that appears on these stones. And also the effect on the marble itself, marble being a far more porous medium than these mudstones, shows that you cannot fake this kind of deposition. And it, although Scott Walter, being a true scientist, he says this does not conclusively prove that these stones were carved and put in a cave by some ancient people, it does seem to indicate that that's the only explanation for the kind of deposition that's on these stones now. So it's gone a long way, really, into helping to validate these things as authentic.
Well, the second article I want to refer to is the Mystic Symbol Ship Artifact, from Burroughs Cave. What was delineated on this Mystic Symbol Ship stone?
That's a very interesting stone.
It
represents a Roman-era type of vessel. It looks very much like a Roman vessel, and it appears to be nearing shore. And on the shore, there is a figure, a kind of a welcoming figure, like a Christ-like figure. And above and between both the vessel that's arriving and the figure standing on shore, there is a depiction, obviously, of the sun. And the sun is radiating its rays towards this figure. Well, in the sun is a very unusual glyph. And before his untimely death last fall, it was a very brilliant epigrapher. His name was David Allen Deal.
He died in the fall, last fall?
Yes, he passed away last fall.
Oh, my.
Yeah, it's quite a loss. He and you would have really gotten along
well. We did. We got along well. As a matter of fact, he was on our show a couple of times.
Really? I didn't know that. That's fabulous.
Yes. I mean, one of his books, my God, it was 800 pages. I'll never forget. I mean, he was so generous with his research and time. I'm so sorry that he passed on because he seemed to me to be decades ahead of...
Well, what especially interested me in his connection with you is that he was also a tremendous artist. He was what you call a populist artist. In other words, he just didn't do framed canvases and so on. He did car art, I guess they refer to it.
Oh,
you know, he designed cars and billboards and things like this. So it's somewhat in your ballywick, actually.
Well, we had a lot in common, and I was just amazed. He found that something in the stone was really quite a shock. I had a shock for the establishment, that is.
One of his greatest achievements was the decipherment of this particular glyph, which appears in two fabulous collections, which the establishment, of course, completely trashed. One is the Burroughs Cave, and the other one is called the Michigan Tablets. And the Michigan Tablets are a completely separate collection, nothing similar at all to what's found in southern Illinois. The Michigan Tablets were found also by the thousands, not 7,000, more like a little over 2,000, between 2,000 and 3,000 of these tablets that were found. These tablets were made of slate, mostly. They were buried in Indian mounds. And when the very first pioneers came across the state of Michigan in the early part of the 19th century, they were mostly farmers, of course, and they found in Michigan, as in many parts of North America, many of these so-called Indian mounds everywhere, hundreds and hundreds of them. In the state of Wisconsin alone, there were surveyed a minimum of 10,000 effigy mounds just in the state of Wisconsin. We have no idea how many thousands there were in the state of Michigan, but certainly thousands. Well, in any case, when the early pioneers were coming across and they would see these mounds, they would break into them thinking there might be treasures or souvenirs, and sometimes there were treasures or souvenirs. Mostly, though, the farmers just cleared these mounds out of the way to make way for their farmland, their pasture land. Well, in doing this, and this only was in the state of Michigan, interestingly enough, no place else. As the farmers broke up these old mounds, they found these tablets that were inscribed with an unknown language, a written language, and they also featured biblical scenes. The biblical scene that was most often portrayed was obviously Noah's flood. There were also portrayed kind of calendars, like little calendar stones. Although the illustrations were rather crude, the writing was elegant. It is elegant. And no one's been able to make a stab at what this represents.
Well, I need to go back before we run out of this segment.
Oh, okay.
But David Deal, the last thing I wanted to point out, Worthy, what looks to me to be almost like cuneiform strokes up there in this sun. Is that the sun? Because there's a comet also above it. But tell us about that. No, when we come back, because we're well past the time when we should have taken our first break. When we come back, tell us a little about these cuneiform strokes and what they might mean in regards to why this is so important.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll be back with our guest, Frank Joseph, the editor-in-chief of Ancient American, telling us the exciting new stories in their latest issue, AncientAmerican.com, 1-877-494-0044. researchers at Johns Hopkins are seeking volunteers with a current or past diagnosis of cancer who have anxiety or sadness about their cancer. Volunteers are needed to participate in a scientific study of self-exploration and personal meaning brought about by psilocybin, a psychoactive substance found in mushrooms, which has been used for centuries as a sacrament for religious and spiritual purposes. Volunteers enrolled in the study will receive careful preparation and 2 sessions in which they will receive psilocybin in a comfortable, supportive setting. Structured guidance will be provided during the session and afterwards to facilitate integration of the experiences. The study complies with FDA regulations. Volunteer must be between the ages of 21 and 70, have no personal history of severe psychiatric illness or recent history of alcoholism or drug abuse. To volunteer or more information, please call 410-550-5990 or visit cancer-insight.org. Confidentiality will be maintained for all applicants and participants. That's 410-550-5990 or www.cancer-insight.org.
This is Kevin Randall, author of Conspiracy of Silence, Project Moondust. You are listening to 21st Century Radio's Dr. Bob Hieronymus, the best show on the air. Maka alohi lo,
you're always in my heart. Oh, I love that music. Oh, indeed. Well, welcome back to 21st Century Radio with our guest, Frank Joseph, editor-in-chief of Ancient American Magazine, telling us about the new exciting stories in the latest issue of AncientAmerican.com. 1-877-494-0044. Now, David Deal drew an important conclusion here. What did he consider was most important about this?
Not only a conclusion that David Deal came up with, in a series of articles for Ancient American Magazine, he conclusively proved, and I think he made this abundantly clear to readers, and it came out some years ago, and no one's been able to fault it. His research was so meticulous that he was able to identify one of these cuneiform glyphs that appears both on the Burroughs Cave artifacts, although very few, a few of them, like this one stone that we featured, and they mostly appear in greater profusion on these Michigan tablets that I mentioned. I needed a little time to explain to our listeners that that's where the symbol is mostly found, on this other collection that's completely unrelated to the Burroughs Cave artifacts. Burroughs Cave artifacts go back to about 41 A.D., the Michigan tablets, they are much later, but they're certainly long before Columbus. They go back to about 450 A.D., and they represent a Coptic Christian immigration to Michigan that took place at that time. Well, anyway, this glyph that appears consistently through the Michigan tablets and occasionally on the Burroughs Cave stones really mystified everyone. What does this symbol mean? What could it possibly mean? It resembles four lines. And the two middle lines have a horizontal strike going through them. And the lines themselves, they look like little nails. They're squat at the top. So David Deal devoted, it must have been close to 10 years working on that. He traveled, I think, to Israel and to Syria and so forth, when you could do that sort of thing, and some of the museums, and trying to figure this out and talk to experts. Well, in a nutshell, what this glyph means, he was able to not only identify it, but also how it sounds. And the sound that it makes is Yahweh.
Oh, my.
It is the name of God. Mm-hmm. And his article is way too complex and long for me to even begin to summarize here. But I challenge anyone to fault his research on that. I was immensely impressed, and I think it stands the test. And not only that, but after David identified that this is a sign of God, Yahweh, the Hebrew God, is that it begins to now illuminate and throw light on so many of these artifacts. Now they become far more clear than they did before. So, not only that, of course, but we now know the identity, partial identity, of some of these people who came here. These were, we believe that they were Hebrews who, of course, they had a hard time in the ancient world. They've always had a hard time.
They certainly have.
But they made the choice of either staying behind in ancient Rome, getting crucified, or else becoming boat people. And at least some of them thought that, and I'm convinced that that's either that or followers of an early type of variation of Hebrew sect or whatever. In any case, there are certainly people who knew about Yahweh who came here. That's also validated by Native American traditions. There are several Native American tribes which talk about their sacred word. These are lodge traditions now, and there's sacred lodge traditions that talk about Yod-Heh-Vah as being the name of God that's not supposed to even be mentioned except in a special context. So I believe that there's really no doubt that this stone that's portrayed in ancient America in this issue that shows this ship, this Roman-era ship, it's landing, and here's the sun shining on what appears to be the rest of the stone is not shown here. There's a man standing on the shore. It doesn't show that here, but it does show the sun, or like you say, possibly a comet, but it really does look like the sun shining on this glyph for Yahweh, the name of God. And in between the ship, sailing on the sea and the land that it's headed for, there's a kind of a serpent, a sea serpent. And that's been interpreted in various ways. We don't really know for sure, but perhaps it represents challenges.
Or it really could be one of those horse-headed type of creatures that have one that was photographed out in British Columbia back in the 30s. Looked very similar to that.
Still seen, by the way.
And it's still, yes, they're still seen out there. Now, well, I just want to conclude that what's in this article, it's basically, he says, for reasons of secrecy, the writers invented a new Hebrew alphabet based on the use of cuneiform strokes. This is really ingenious. It was their secret and was intended to die with them. Perhaps they were originally Jews from Babylon, that is, people from you. Isn't that something? I mean, really, that is just extraordinary. Well, we got to move on here. There are so many important articles, but tell us a little bit about the important work of Gunnar Thompson in regards to the discovery of the New World, because we're going to take a look at something here that certainly is going to change the way corn is viewed around the planet.
Gunnar Thompson is a very brilliant creature. He is a full-fledged archaeologist. He's one of the very few scientists who was part of the mainstream system of investigating our past, and he worked in Cahokia, for example, in Illinois, and excavating down there. And when he found all these telltale traces to connections overseas, he was, in short, booted out of the profession.
Well, of course.
And so now he writes the books he wants to, and he makes his living doing other things. But Gunnar Thompson is certainly one of the big guns, as it were, in what they call cultural diffusionism. Cultural diffusionism is the term for people that do not believe that Columbus was first, but Columbus was last. And that this is not to diminish Columbus's achievement at all, but it means that he was preceded by a lot of people. Mm-hmm. That's what cultural diffusionism is about, and that's what Gunnar Thompson tells us. Gunnar Thompson is especially focused on the identity and the achievement of Columbus, which really depended a lot on the people that came before him. For example, he had a Portuguese map that showed him just where to go. The Portuguese had been to North America for at least 10 years, probably like 15 or so, before he set sail. And, of course, he was aware of the Norse achievement, but didn't want to go the northerly route because he was afraid his ships wouldn't make it. They were inferior to the long ships that were manned by the Vikings. He was wise to take the southern route. So Gunnar Thompson has done a marvelous job in really putting Columbus's achievement, and it is an achievement, into context. And it's not the miraculous discovery that we're all believed to have taken place.
Well, in this particular article, Thompson's article, Egyptian Queen Beat Columbus by 3,000 Years, What led Gunnar to make the statement in regards to corn? Because I think this is really just going to be something that's a lot more exciting than most people think.
Well, Gunnar Thompson was able to find that the corn that is grown here, called maize over here, is supposed to have been something that's not known anyplace else outside the Americas until Columbus arrived here. And it turns out that the varieties of maize that were grown in Mexico and other parts of the New World were also known in ancient Egypt. There were strains of it, especially all through ancient India, and that Gunnar Thompson's been able to point out in, I don't think it's in this article specifically, but certainly in other work that he's done, that many of the statues of Hindu gods, and these statues were made, about 1,000 or 1,200 years ago in the temples of Mahara, for example. These gods are portrayed holding ears of New World corn, which supposedly nobody knew about in the ancient Old World until Columbus and his followers brought it back. What he really emphasizes, what Thompson talks about in this article, is primarily the achievement made by Queen Hatshepsut. She was a ruler of ancient Egypt around 1,500 years before Christ. And she sent off an expedition to what they called the Land of Punt. And this expedition took 3 years. It was involved an entire fleet of ships. And they returned with all manner of fabulous luxury items. No one has ever found out what the Land of Punt refers to. It's now generally understood by Egyptologists themselves, however, that there was no single Land of Punt. That Punt, or the Land of Punt, was meant to represent the expedition itself. It wasn't a single place. It was a whole bunch of places that they visited. So when you said you were going to Punt, it meant that you were going really off on this voyage. See, that's the difficulty in translating the Egyptian hieroglyphs. We've been able to read Egyptian hieroglyphs for over 200 years, or just about 200 years. Trouble is, the Egyptians, they didn't write straight. They loved to pun. Everything refers to something else. So it's very difficult sometimes. For example, they said, Pharaoh took his sister as a wife. And so everybody thought, well, the Pharaohs are committing incest all the time. They're marrying their sisters. Well, no, see, that's completely wrong. Now it's learned that was just a way that he referred to his wife. I mean, I love you along with my sister and so on like that. It was a term of endearment. So that's why it's difficult to understand some of the texts that are given sometimes.
Well, there are more articles on more possible evidence of pre-Columbian transoceanic voyages, such as in the terracotta head that may be Phoenician found in Las Balsas, Mexico. But we need to get to the Kennewick Man. We always talk about the Kennewick Man, but there's always new stuff that I think is important, because this is let's touch on that right now. The Kennewick Man by Patrick C. Quinard states, is the kind of discovery you hope you will never find. Now, what does he mean by the kind of discovery you hope you never find?
Well, the discovery he's referring to, of course, is the Kennewick Man. He's proved to be extremely politically incorrect all this time, because it turns out, of course, that not only is his age quite remote, he goes back 9 or 11,000 years ago, and he's in an area of North America, where it was presumed there were few, if any, people there. The trouble with him, of course, is that he's Caucasian. This isn't to say that he's a member of any modern white race. He was white. He was no doubt about it. He was a Caucasoid, but of a race which no longer exists and appears to be related to the Ainu, A-I-N-U, who were the original inhabitants of Japan. They also were Caucasian. Most people don't realize this, but Japan was not an Asian or an Oriental land until about 200 B.C. And before that time, that it was a white collection of islands inhabited by this unknown Caucasian race. And apparently they were quite the seafarers. because that's what Mr. Kennewick Man is in the state of Washington. Chouinard's article points out that what makes it difficult for people to accept is not only his Caucasian background, even though he's not related to any modern Caucasian race at all. And it's also difficult because he's living in an area where archaeologists tell us that probably nobody was there, mostly because of his manner of death. This man had a hard life. He shows a number of severe wounds, and eventually he was killed. He's a murder victim. As a matter of fact, when his skeleton was first found, it was assumed that he was a modern murder victim. And although he is a murder victim, it turns out that his case has grown cold as over the last 9,000 to 11,000 years.
Yeah.
And it's a manner of his death. He may have been actually a warrior of some kind, either that or a victim, because he said he had many broken bones that healed, and he was in a difficult situation. So it would appear that he was in conflict. He and his fellow Caucasians were in conflict with Native Americans, because other Kennewick type of human remains have been found, none as well preserved as him. There's one called Bull Woman, B-U-H-L Woman. She's also related to him, at least racially, and she also was murdered. Matter of fact, as I said, I think there's about now 8 or 9 remains of Kennewick type of skeletons, and they're all been massacred, all killed violently. And they're spread over a wide area from state of Washington all the way to the Dakotas. So it's... That also sort of inhibits investigation because it doesn't please some particular people.
Well, what does the author of this mean by new planetary gospel? That this is kind of like a representative of a new planetary gospel in regards to the theory of Clovis Man.
Well, Clovis Man, of course, is considered one of the earliest human communities ever. This is in the American Southwest, and they supposedly settled in this area shortly after the end of the last ice age, and then for some reason they vanished away, and that they're the first tool makers, as it were, called Clovis because of the flints, mm-hmm. the points that they made. Well, apparently, there are also some tools that are associated now with Kennewick Man, although not officially. And so it appears that he was also a tool maker at a time that was at least contemporary with Clovis, but in a different part of the country. So that also has skewered our conception of the ancient past.
Mm-hmm. Well, our ancient future is in doubt right here. We have to take a break. And when we return, I'd like to go, there are so many other articles here, but the one I'd like to focus on is another, to my opinion, a mind-blowing article, was the one on the discovery of the islands in the Atlantic as found in a carved rock in County Meath, Ireland, over 5,000 years ago. Wow. We were trying, when we were in Ireland, we were desperately trying to get to County Meath, but it was closed at that time. So we had to spend our time elsewhere in the other places, which were almost as good, but I would have loved to have seen this stone. We'll be back with our guest, Frank Joseph, the editor-in-chief of Ancient American Magazine, telling us the numerous exciting stories in this latest issue, ancientamerican.com, 1-877-494-0044.
This is astronomer and paranormal researcher Phil Imbrogno, and you're listening to 21st Century Radio with the amazing Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Above the fruited plain,
You know, God done shed his grace on thee.
Oh, boy, I hate to break in here. I really do. But I've been forced. My producer told me I better had, or she slapped me in the teeth. And, of course, our executive producer, Laura Cortner, is always right. But our guest tonight is Frank Joseph, the editor-in-chief of Ancient American Magazine, telling us, well, these stories you should have heard when you were back in grade school. But, of course, we didn't discover them by then. Frank, this article on the discovery of the islands in the Atlantic is found on a carved rock, in County Meath, in Ireland, over 5,200 years ago. Tell us about this discovery and what that story reveals.
Well, this is, I think, probably the most single important article in the entire magazine, and it certainly is mind-blowing, but it's also incontrovertible, I think. I was really impressed with this. The article is called The Discovery of the Islands in the Atlantic. What's remarkable about this is that, as you said, County Meath is this area central in Ireland, and it's very important. It's the most important area in Ireland archaeologically. Of course, located there is New Grange and a number of very ancient megalithic passage graves that go back to the late 4th millennium B.C. In other words, late and middle 4th millennium B.C., from about 3600 B.C. to about 3000 B.C. It's a very old area. In other words, hundreds and hundreds of years before the Egyptian pyramids were even thought about. Here there's this thriving Stone Age society in Ireland. And a number of these monuments are carved some very peculiar designs and emblems which have absolutely perplexed scholars for many years. But this one article, I think, that we have has put to rest this one set of designs. And it's referring to a place called Lough Cru, which is in County Meath. It's not that far from New Grange. New Grange, by the way, is the oldest building in the world. It's dated back very confidently to 3,200 years before Christ. And it's superbly oriented to sunrise on the winter solstice. And it's just a marvelous place. Not far from there is Lough Cru. And a number of these strange designs, perfectly preserved after all this time, they resemble like flowers and semicircles and so forth, and they have always been understood to be in a kind of arrangement of some kind. They're not just placed there haphazardly. Scholars have always thought that they meant something, that their placement seems to have indicated something. Well, it's up to the authors of this article. One is a gentleman from Holland, is Dr. R.M. de Jong, and the other is an American, J. Wakefield. And together, they've worked on Lough Cru for quite a few years, and they've put their conclusions, their discoveries, in this wonderful article. In a nutshell, it's this. They took the designs off of Lough Cru, made copies of the designs, and tried to see if they paralleled any geography, because there's a suggestion that these different flower designs and lines and semicircles and so forth, they seem to indicate places. Well, nothing seemed to really work until they got ambitious enough to take out a map of the world, and they specifically a map of the North Atlantic, and they were shocked to find that these designs on Lough Cru, which go back to 3,600 years before Christ, attached to no known culture, that these designs perfectly line up as a template. If you take these designs, put them over a map of the Atlantic, you see that they match perfectly major islands throughout the Atlantic Ocean. They refer to Britain, to Greenland, to the Azores, the Canary Islands. So it shows people who had fabulous seafaring capabilities, not hundreds, but thousands of years before we're told anybody dared sail this far. There's even indication of the Bimini Islands, or at least the Bahama Islands in any case. But the most remarkable of all, the thing that I really particularly enjoyed with my interest in Atlantis, is that while all of the designs from Lough Cru perfectly fit the known islands in the North Atlantic, we're talking about Ireland and England, and the Canary Islands, the Madeiras, the Canary Islands. It's remarkable. Two do not, specifically one. They point to an area of the ocean which was described by Plato in 400 B.C., excuse me, about 300 B.C., as being the location for the lost island of Atlantis. So here we're having a map of the North Atlantic, which is touching all of these major landfalls, except for this one place where today, if you go there, it's open sea. It's about, according to this, it's about 300 miles due west of the Straits of Gibraltar. And in fact, that is the suspected location for lost Atlantis.
Yeah.
So this old map, this 5,600-year-old map, seems to indicate not only accurately the landfall throughout the Atlantic, but also the former location of Atlantis. So Atlantis was still in existence at the time that these seafarers put their map on the stone at Loch Ru. I think it's an absolutely amazing discovery. It's just extremely important.
Oh, it is. I just love this article. I mean, because, you know, the chart shown on page 24 only takes you back to 5,700 B.C., well, you're closing in on 8,000 years ago there. And it seems that they were making their discoveries going all the way back to, like if I am to believe this, the Orkneys, 7,600 B.C. This is a long time ago.
It is, but at the same time, you know, as astounding as this is and unbelievable as it used to be, I mean, people that, we're talking about people that are over 7,000, 8,000 years ago that are having in possession of seafaring craft, that would have sounded absolutely fantastic, but it isn't so much anymore in this particular regard. It appears that at the end of the last ice age, about 10 to 13,000 years ago, we don't know exactly what it was. It must have been something in the environment, some major environmental change. That appears to be the real beginning of civilized man. Civilized man did not begin in the Nile Valley or in between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers about 5,000 years ago. Rather, it's more than twice that length of time into the past. Ancient man seems to have been, ancient I'm referring to like Ice Age man, the end of the last ice age. He came out, he survived that ice age, which probably wiped out maybe most of human life. And he survived, and through that survival, he made the transition from savagery or primitive level to becoming civilized. And I think that all the rudiments that we see now, so when we're looking at civilization going back that far and seafarers and so forth, it's understandable in that context. One of the proofs of that is, not just a supposition, are the oldest known cave paintings, which are magnificent works of art. No one denies that these things, I'm talking about at Lascaux and Trois Frères and places like this, Los Molares. These are deep, deep cavernous caves deep in the ground. Everybody has seen them either in television or in books. I don't think you can even visit them much anymore because they're so fragile. But these cave paintings go back to this time when the ice was just retreating. They're about 10 to 13,000 years ago, 9 to 13,000 years ago. And the artwork is already an extremely high level.
And that's exactly where we got to stop. We'll be back with another high level on with Frank Joseph, editor-in-chief of Ancient American Magazine, telling us, giving us some of the stories within this December 08 issue. AncientAmerican.com, 1-877-494-0044.
And talk on Talk Radio 680 WCBM, Baltimore.
From ABC News,